verse 17 of chapter 2 through chapter 3, verse 6, and that is, where is the God of judgment? It was a question being asked at that particular time because people could look around and they could see people that were doing wrong, and they were able to flourish in their evil, and they were continuing to do well. So, you know, it was kind of the concept that we have to be careful of, that God, why don't you blow all these other sinners off the face of the earth so you can prove that we're the good guys and they're the bad guys, and then everything will be taken care of. He'll go on to say why he doesn't do that in a few minutes. Verse 17, you have wearied the Eternal with your words, yet you say, wherein have we wearied him? He does this time and again through this book. God will make a statement, and he says, but the people then kind of come back, but what do you mean, God? What do you mean we wearied you? Well, you wearied him when you said, everyone that does evil is good in the sight of the Eternal, and that he delights in them. So they were doubting God's justice, that all these people must be good because God doesn't strike out and hit them. I find this an interesting phrase in light of the class that we've recently been finishing on the world religions. There is the concept of pluralism, that all these other good people in the world can't all be wrong. In other words, you know, you've got millions of Buddhists and Hindus and Jews and Islamic. All these people, how could they possibly be wrong? Because they're good people, and some of them, you know, with great intentions, you know, all the rest of Christianity for that matter. Some very dedicated. I have a friend that I just got back from the seminar I went to who's going to be on my peer, one of my peers on this doctoral committee, very committed. The president of Harvest Institute, for any of you who've heard of that, but it is dedicated to missionary work in the third world. It is not going there and taking money necessarily. It's helping them to set up pastors to try to help the individuals, and he has worked most of his life to set that up. He's not, you know, a rich person. He's not trying to make money out of the deal. He has a true committed interest in Christianity and in helping those people. You know, my hat's off to him for his commitment. I want him as a part of my board and what I'm doing for my doctoral because he is so committed. As we look at the world then, and as, you know, if we can look at it from two or three different viewpoints. One, we look at it from Christianity. If we were to place ourselves with all Christianity, Catholics, Protestants, any other, you know, Christian sect you want to name, as it looks at the world with all these other world religions, well, how can they not be taken care of? Good, committed people. We then can go the next step, and that is within our congregation, and, you know, most churches do this, within their congregation as they look out at Christianity. And you see good people. This question then comes up. Everyone that does evil is good in the sight of the Eternal, and he delights in them. So even though we would believe there are certain laws, certain ways of life that we must go through Christ, first of all, would be the focus of our doctrine of the doctrine of Christianity, that one must go through Christ. In the name of Christ, Acts 4, verse 12, is salvation. So if we have to go through him, well, how can the Buddhists who don't believe in Christ, the Hindus, Islamic, I mean, on and on we can go with the vast majority of humanity. You know, how are they, how do we resolve the aspect of them being basically good people? And by good, I don't mean perfect, but with hearts that are committed to helping their people, Buddhists that are concerned for Buddhists. There was another man at this seminar that I went to who's a Buddhist, very fine man. Turned out we were having a peer day together, so it was just four or five of us together for a full day going through some things. And at dinner, it came out what I did for a living, that he was a Buddhist, so we started talking about the things that are in common between Christianity. He views me as a Christian. I don't take it any further than that, you know, unless they ask. And, of course, they want to know where I taught, so I tell them where I teach. And, well, what's that affiliated with? So Worldwide Church of God. There are a few that know of Garner Ted Armstrong, and then I take a step back to Herbert Armstrong. And, you know, so anyway, we get in some interesting conversations as to my beliefs and where I stand. But for this individual, it was enough just that I was a Christian, because him being a Buddhist We then, you know, got into some very interesting discussions about Buddhism and his commitment. And I think he's been a Buddhist for about 5 years. He works in Thailand, back and forth. So I was able to talk about our projects in Thailand, and he has some projects there that he's involved in too for the government. Anyway, we do get this aspect that after a while we can see the world and we kind of get the feeling, well, how come God doesn't declare his name more vividly to show who his people are and that he doesn't destroy the evil? He goes on in verse 17. Or, where is the God of judgment? This is the way that they word him. Where is the God of judgment? God, why don't you reach out? Why don't you do something? Well, the answer is found in chapter 3. Where is the God of judgment? He goes on then to explain it. Behold, I will send my messenger. So he's now going to talk about judgment and how judgment is meted out. Behold, I will send my messenger, and he shall prepare the way before me. My messenger is Malachi. And he shall prepare the way before me. Now there are several messengers that have been sent. The one that is spoken of specifically here in verse 1, and he undoubtedly is talking about John the Baptist. Matthew chapter 11, verse 10, because Christ quotes this and says this was John the Baptist. He also refers to the messenger with the name of Elijah, chapter 4, verse 5. Chapter 4, verse 5, that was referring to John the Baptist. And we'll get to that in a minute. But back to chapter 3, verse 1, we see a messenger that would come. Now, there are five messengers mentioned in the book, so we'll interject this at this point. The five Malachis. First of all, Malachi the prophet, chapter 1, verse 1. The second are the priests. Chapter 2, verse 7, the priests are spoken of as the messenger of the eternal of hosts. So priests are messengers, chapter 2, verse 7. Number 3, John the Baptist, chapter 3, verse 1a. 3, verse 1a, who is also the Elijah of chapter 4, verse 5. He is also the Elijah, John the Baptist, chapter 3, verse 1a. First half of the verse, in other words, is the Elijah of chapter 4, verse 5, for Christ's first coming. Got that? Okay, number 4. Fourth messenger we see is Christ. Chapter 3, verse 1b. And I'm going to just leave this as number 4. We should all know that Christ, as a messenger, comes twice. He came in his first coming, and he is yet to come in his second coming. But he is still the messenger. It's the same individual, comes in two different forms, one as a human, the second will be as God. Spirit composition. And then the fifth messenger is the church. The fifth messenger is the church, chapter 4, verses 5 and 6. The church as the final Elijah. The final Elijah of chapter 4, verse 5, for the second coming of Christ. Okay, with me? Let's go back to chapter 3, verse 1 then. Behold, I will send my messenger, and he, John the Baptist, will prepare the way before me. Again, this is God speaking through Malachi, and the God of the Old Testament was Christ, so he was preparing the way for Christ, Christ's first coming. Mark chapter 1, verses 1 through 4. Prepare the way before me. Mark 1, verses 1 through 4. And the Lord, whom you seek, shall suddenly come to his temple. So the Lord is speaking of Jesus Christ in his first coming, as he comes as Savior. Shall suddenly come to his temple, even the messenger of the covenant whom you delight in. So we have this word Malachi then for the Lord. Messenger is Malachi, referring to Christ. Whom you delight in, behold, he shall come, says the Eternal of Hosts. And Christ did come to the temple, John 2, verse 14. He cleansed the temple. as he also then came to his temple, the church. Matthew 16, verse 18, and cleansed the church. 1 John 1, verse 7 says that he cleanses us spiritually as individuals within his church. So he came suddenly, shall come suddenly to his temple. We can see that temple in two ways, the physical temple that he cleansed as well as the spiritual temple. Verse 2. Now we see another aspect of this Malachi, the Malachi of Christ. Who shall abide the day of his coming? Who shall stand when he appears? For he is like a refiner's fire and like fuller's soap. So it appears at this point that we're projecting now to his second coming, because it's at that point that we can read in 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, verses 8 and 9 of the fire of Christ's return, the judgment of Christ as he returns. We could tie in Zechariah chapter 14 with the battle that takes place. And I think we've gone through, looking at the minor prophets as far as the fantastic army that he has, the fire, the cataclysmic battle in the Valley of Jehoshaphat as he fights against those armies. So who shall stand when he appears? What's the answer to that? Who shall stand when Christ appears? Okay, another term for it? Those in the church, yes? Okay, I think I would interpret it that way. I mean, who's going to stand before his coming? He's talking about those that are disobedient, that fight against him as he comes. They're not going to stand. They're going to be wiped out. And I think within the context, we can say for sure there's one group already spoken of in the minor prophets. The just shall live by faith. Habakkuk 2, verse 4. That's how you stand in the face of evil. Again, within this context, we're still going back to the aspect of all this evil in the world, everything that goes on. Many people, though we would view them in a social context as good people, committed to their marriages, committed to life. But as far as salvation, the salvific process, I think is a term that's used, as far as that goes, and you're living in this world that is not obeying God, who shall stand? The just shall live by faith. The just shall stand. For he is like a refiner's fire and like fuller's soap. Fuller's is better translated bleachers. It's a soap that would bleach out the garments. A refiner's fire. So the purpose is to purify. It is to correct. It is tribulation that comes and that culminates in Christ's return. He shall sit as a refiner and purifier of silver. What they would do with silver is they would get it to a boiling point and they would have a refiner that would sit over it and with a scoop would take out the dross. The dross is that slag that separates from the silver and will rise to the top, and you filter it off the top and remove it. And he's talking about one sitting over it with this bubbling cauldron of silver as it's being purified, as the impurities are taken out one by one. He shall purify the sons of Levi, and shall purge them as gold and silver, that they may offer unto the Eternal an offering in righteousness. So he sits over the silver, removing the dross until it shines like a mirror, until it is purified, and then judgment begins. Now, there are several scriptures we can apply to this. Judgment begins at the house of God. So it begins with the priests within the book of Malachi. The priests are responsible for the worship, and they had better get back to teaching. We already talked about the cycle that was set up, that they were not teaching the truth about tithing and offerings and how to worship God. So he's talking here, he's warning them that they will be refined. So judgment starts with the temple priests and Levites. We can apply that then even, within the millennium, as that will be reestablished. The church itself is then judged. 1 Peter 4, verse 17. That judgment starts with the church. Now, even within the book of Peter, we see that we are spoken of as a nation of priests. So the entirety of the church is as the priests that were supposed to be purified, and that is brought out here in verse 3. David.
I'm just a little confused. On 1 Peter 4:17, it says the church is like in judgment now. Has the priests already been judged?
1 Peter 4, verse 17 says that judgment shall begin at the house of the eternal. If we scarcely be saved, where shall the righteous stand? So the message to Malachi is for those people right then, right? I mean, he's saying, look, he's going to send messengers, and they better listen to the messengers. He sends Malachi. Malachi, whose name means messenger, they're hearing that report. They also know that there are priests. He's already identified the priests in chapter 2, verse 7. As they are supposed to be preaching this message, he says that he will send the one that they could then identify in chapter 3 as the messenger coming to the temple, and that he would purify these Levites and priests. Okay, so that's for their time. For ours, we can see for end time that it is with the house of God. There aren't priests per se at this point in the Levitical system, so the specifics of that would have been at their time. Now, we might also be able to tie in a literal interpretation at the very end. It is quite probable that the Jews and the Levites will have sacrifices going on at that point, that the Levites will need to be purified of sin so that then as a millennium starts, the sacrifices can resume. So there's a purification that takes place in that aspect. So this verse from that aspect also can be taken literally. Okay? Going on. So we see judgment begins at the house of God. Verse 4, then shall the offering of Judah and Jerusalem be pleasant to the eternal, as in the days of old, as in the former years. So at this time he says, you know, for them, their offerings were not pleasant. He wanted them to clean up their act, then they would be pleasant. You know, we read that in Hosea 6, verse 6, that he didn't want sacrifice. He wanted mercy. He wanted a commitment first, and then he would grant them the blessing from their sacrifice. Haggai chapter 2. That aspect of, they were building the temple, but still he wanted that spiritual commitment from them. Verse 5, and I will come near to you to judgment. I will be a swift witness against the sorcerers and the adulterers, the false swearers, those that oppress the hireling and the wages, the widow, the fatherless, that turn aside the stranger from his right. Fear not me, says the Eternal of Hosts. So we see judgment, first of all, at God's house, the priests, the Levites, in verses 3 and 4. Then in verse 5, we see judgment against the people and their leaders, their secular leaders, for the sins that they have committed. Those that oppress the hireling and his wages, the widow, the fatherless, turn aside the stranger. I think we have this in our list, do we not, Russ, for that liberation thing I was having you work on? I want to make sure that this one is there. Verse 6, I am the Eternal, and I change not. Therefore, you sons of Jacob are not consumed. He's telling the people here at this point, those who are looking out and trying to put the blame on everyone else, and it's a kind of hearkening back to Habakkuk. Remember Habakkuk's question of, how long till you correct these people? He's talking about those people in Jerusalem at that particular point. God says it won't be long and the Chaldeans are going to take him. Then he wants to know, how long are you going to take until you correct them? Because actually, they're more evil than we are, God. So it keeps getting back to this point. And God says, I change not so that Jacob is not consumed. He had every right to consume Jacob, to consume the Jews because of their sins. And if God were going to intervene and he was going to destroy all the, quote, heathen, end quote, nations, where would Jacob stand? Because Jacob had the law of God. They understood the law of God and they should have been keeping it and setting the example for all these other nations. And yet they weren't doing that. So he says, I, the Eternal, I change not. He changes not from the aspect that he loves Israel, Hosea 11, verse 1, that he's concerned for them, and that he corrects so that people will repent. Amos 4, verse 6. And from that aspect that he doesn't change. So the answer to chapter 2, verse 17, where is the God of judgment? Right where he's always been. On his throne. Still judging. Still waiting. still looking towards the return of Jesus Christ, when that judgment is then going to take place, as far as, you know, for those who are being judged now, as far as reward and opportunity, the gift of salvation, which comes through grace. Okay, chapter 7, verse 12 is God's judgment. Then he goes on regarding tithing. He says, yeah, just because I don't reach down and with lightning zot people to, you know, to show that they're wrong, he says, you'd better look around, and I have judged the land. There is a lack of blessing upon the land because you've not been properly tithing and giving offerings. So rather than them looking everywhere else and wondering how come God's not correcting others, he's saying you need to internalize a little bit more as a nation. You need to see where you need to make, where you need to obey God. So chapter 3, verses 7 through 12 is God's judgment regarding tithing. God's judgment regarding tithing can be seen through the blessings and cursings that have occurred in the nation. So where is the God of judgment? Well, the God of judgment is on his throne. He is judging. He is seeing what's going on. And in fact, he is correcting every son whom he loves. Where does it say that? That God corrects every son whom he loves. Kent? Book of Hebrews, that's good. That's a start. Anybody got a chapter? 12, that's a good chapter. And maybe what verse? 6 through 11 is a whole concept, but verse 6, I think, more specifically says, see, if we could all take the test together instead of this individual stuff that just creates competition, then we could all pass, right? Someone someday needs to figure that all out. Maybe we need a paper on that. And then we wouldn't have to go through all this testing stuff. Anyway, verse 7, even from the days of your fathers, you have gone away from my ordinances and have not kept them. So rather than pointing the finger at everybody else, he says, look at yourselves. You have not kept the ordinances. Return unto me, I will return unto you, says the Eternal of Hosts. But you said, wherein shall we return? What do you mean, return to you, God? We've, you know, always worshipped you. Will a man rob God? Yet you have robbed me. You know, how do you rob God? The people would say, you know, God has everything. What do you mean, robbing him? Well, you've robbed me in tithes and in offerings. Leviticus 27, verse 30 says that the tithe is the eternals. Leviticus 27, verse 30. And Numbers 18, verse 21 says that that tithe was to go to the priests. You are cursed with a curse, for you have robbed me, even this whole nation. And the term me is emphatic in the Hebrew, for you have robbed me. He really emphasizes to them that by not paying tithes, by not giving their offerings, they were robbing God. And I'm sure they felt justified. Times were hard. They were having difficulties. So therefore, you know, why should they continue to tithe? Bring you all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be meat in my house. And prove me now herewith, says the Eternal Host, if I will not open you the windows of heaven and pour out upon you a blessing, that there shall be room enough to receive it. So what he is saying specifically in this verse, as far as pouring out the windows, some people kind of view this as somehow the windows of heaven are going to open and doubloons are going to rain down, or we're going to double bank accounts by some, you know, great miracle or whatever takes place. I do not interpret it that way. Yes, there have been some people that have great financial blessings as a result. That's great. But that should not be the test of tithing. That, do I have more money now than before? I had a man who, about 15 years ago, got a bit disgruntled. He was having hard times. He was looking at his tithes and didn't want to continue to pay tithes. And his comment was, well, if I had saved all these tithes I've given over these years, and he'd been tithing for many years, I would have $100,000 in the bank that I could live off for the rest of my life. And he kind of begrudged God the fact that he had given his tithes to God, and look what he could have had in the bank. Now, there is some illogic with that. What is it? Okay, well, it's God's tithes, and it should go to him, yeah. Yeah. Man, if I could go back and do that too, and, you know, tithes aside, you know, with all the tithes I've paid, I could do the other money that, you know, we have saved over through the years. By saved, I mean, you know, that we have spent, that saved us X number of dollars because we got this good deal and whatever. And, yeah, I could say, oh, I'd have so much money. I dare say that habits are built. And I think one tremendous blessing of tithing is it does teach, what's that word I want? We don't do it very often. Budgeting, yeah, yeah, I knew it was there somewhere. But it's supposed to teach, you know, budgeting, that you, therefore, you use your money more effectively. Maybe he would or should have had more money than he would have had otherwise if he learned how to properly budget. There's some individuals that have, you know, lost four fortunes because they have all kinds of money, but they never learn how to budget and to spend it properly and to save properly, and then they lose it all, and then they start working again and losing it, and they kind of live with that schemata of life. But here he is within the context. He's talking to a nation. He's talking to the whole nation. You bring in tithes, and I will bless you with rain. Zechariah 14, he talks about sending rain, that is going to be one of the important aspects within the millennium. There'll be room enough to receive it. And he goes on from this aspect of a national perspective of rain, of blessings that would come as a result of that. And yes, you know, those blessings may be monetary. They may also be the fact that you just have plenty to eat and that you have good food to eat, and that you have a family that stays together because you're now keeping God's laws and committing yourself to God. That maybe that you have your health. And then some people, you know, well, yeah, but I've always had my health. But maybe you wouldn't if you aren't, you know, properly serving God. I mean, there's so many of these factors that are intangible, whatever, that we need to count our blessings from the many, many things we have and not just limit that to financial. Though that may be one tremendous blessing, of course. So anyway, neither shall the vine cast her fruit before the time in the field, says the Eternal of Hosts. All nations shall call you blessed, for you shall be a delightsome land, says the Eternal of Hosts. So within this context, we see it on a national basis. Surely it applies to us on an individual basis. That God looks down, and that as we tithe, as we have a commitment that goes beyond just, you know, just the physical writing of a check and whatever, but the commitment in our hearts and in our lives and whatever, there are many, many blessings that we do receive from that. And this is one of the things, you know, when you think back to Israel as we kind of finish up the Old Testament with this, you look back to Israel, why did God call Israel? Of all the nations, why did he call Israel and not all the world at that particular time? That others could be called through them. If Israel had properly kept God's laws and had properly used God's law, which would be to treat your neighbor as yourself and with respect, then in turn God could have shown the other nations his laws through them. That's why God selected them, to be a vehicle of showing the rest of the world his law. Just like he chooses a church now, so that in time he will, through the church, show the rest of the world his laws. But so he's saying at this point, if you'll come in, you'll do this, all the nations shall call you blessed. You shall be a delightsome land. Then there would be spinoff for them. We saw the same thing in Zechariah chapter 14, because people are going to come to obey God in the millennium. Others are going to say, oh, you know, it's not profitable. You know, what's the profit in going up there and taking time off when we could be harvesting the land, or we could be enjoying the after the harvest and whatever. They don't go up. And therefore, God doesn't give them rain. They then start realizing the curses. Realizing the curses as Judah had not realized them to this point. In Nehemiah 13, verses 10 through 12, we see that Judah did come to understand where they were sinning. They did obey. They were blessed by God. They were blessed by God. Unfortunately, they did not stay steadfast with God, and those blessings did not last as they will in the millennium. Okay, chapter 3, verses 13 through chapter 4, verse 3. 3:13, 4, verse 3, we see a contrast of God's punishment of the wicked, the contrast of God's punishment of the wicked with his vindication of the righteous. Your words have been stout against me. Stout means insistent, unyielding, defiant against God, says the Eternal. Yet you say, what have we spoken so much against you? You know, how have we spoken? Well, they spoke one to another about God and complaining and the difficulties, and that's how they did it. So we see the skeptics in verses 13 through 15. The skeptic says in verse 14, it is vain to serve God. It's vain. Why should I serve God? And I think back to this man who tried to tally up all these tithes, you know, over X number of years. I suppose we could do the same thing with how much money we've, you know, spent for alcohol. You know, maybe some of those of us are older, have families, or have students in all the time, or whatever. If I were to go back and figure my alcohol bill and party bill over 7 years of being at college, how much money would I have? I dare not even spend any time on it. But that's all, you know, well spent, that someone told me. Usually the students who were drinking it. And I don't begrudge that. That's fine. You know, we can do the same thing then with tithes in our service to God. And you see some individuals, after they have served for some time period within the congregation, that if someone else is promoted to deacon, that they served alongside, and they're not promoted that time. I'll guarantee you, any time you ordain somebody, it is a test of character for many others in the congregation. Because there are individuals sitting out there that have worked maybe just as hard as this individual. Maybe could do the job just as well. But maybe there's only need for one more deacon and not two or three. And you have to make that decision and you have to do that. And those other people have to swallow real hard sometimes. And they congratulate the person they go up. And, you know, with real feelings of, you know, glad that the other person could do it. But, you know, let's face the fact that we're all human. And that there is, you know, in service, there is a desire to be able to do more service. If one can be ordained so they can do more service, then so much the better. And there are some of those, you know, those attitudes that spring up at that particular point. And sometimes it can be felt. It's vain to serve God. What has it gotten me? I talked to one deacon who left the church eventually, came back for a while, and then left again. That he was really upset because of all the time that he had spent helping the ministry and doing things and whatever. Now, if he'd really been doing it for service during that time period and not because he was trying to get something or because he felt like he had to do it or whatever, and I'm not saying that there haven't been mistakes also by ministers in the past. There have been, you know, I hope we're not making the same mistake now, and Mr. Dukach has really tried to address this problem, but sometimes the problem is taking advantage of individuals in the congregations that have certain skills and whatever. And what happens sometimes is the member volunteers their time and effort, and they end up spending a lot of time doing it and whatever, and then if they were doing it for the wrong reason, then sometimes they got a real attitude tester when it comes up to ordination time for someone else, or just the fact when, you know, the opportunities are handed out, who's going to be a coach over teams or who's going to be over YOU or YES and whatever, we got to give thought to that. So, vain to serve the Eternal. What profit is it that we have kept the ordinance, that we have walked mournfully before the Lord of hosts? So they were kind of walking mournfully in penitence, you know, their problems. So they question how much profit there is in having loyalty to God. And now we call the proud happy, yea, they that work wickedness are set up. Yea, they that tempt God are even delivered. So they kind of look at all the evil that's going on, and again, we're back to chapter 2, verse 17. All this wickedness, all the evil that is occurring, and it continues, and there are, you know, you can find mafiosa, and any race, you know, for fear I, you know, any Italians in here get mad at me. There are other members of the mafiosa, I suppose, that aren't Italian. You can go to Vegas and you can find a lot of people that are rich. You can find drug dealers and cartels in South America. You can go anywhere in the world and you can find some people that are making buku bucks. And they're doing 98% of it illegally to get those bucks. And if we're going to just sit around and we're going to determine based upon financial benefit whether we obey God or not, or whether someone is righteous or not, then he says we're not properly seeing judgment. Ecclesiastes 8 verse 11, very important for that, that because judgment is not speedily executed, the hearts of men continue in their evil, and they continue to do, you know, what they want to do. So we have to be careful that as we see that, that we don't start screaming, where is justice? We have to know who is the God of this world. We have to know that there's a certain period of time that Satan has allowed his freedom on this earth as God prepares a people for the millennium. And that, you know, to go around and back to a question that I suppose I posed earlier, and that is, what about all these, quote, good people, end quote, that are Buddhists, Islamic, you know, have hearts of gold and would do anything for anyone else, but they just don't understand? Well, that day is coming for them, and I believe that those people, that the vast majority of mankind are going to have salvation. Because when they're finally hit with the fact that pluralism is not the way to salvation, and when they finally, in the millennium or in the second resurrection, are told that Jesus Christ is the one and the only way, and then, as was stated, every knee shall bow at that point, or if they refuse to bow, then they will not have salvation. So we then see the contrast of the faithful, verses 16 and 17. They that feared the Eternal spoke often one to another. The Eternal hearkened and heard it, and a book of remembrance was written before him for them that feared the Eternal and that thought upon his name. So they spoke often one to another to support one another, to strengthen one another. Galatians 6, verses 1 and 2 ties in with this. Galatians 6, 1 through 2. Feared the Eternal and that thought upon his name. So it is important that we be thinking about God, that our meditation be upon God, and that our reverence, appropriate fear of God, is in our hearts. The last chapter of Hebrews refers to this, having the proper respect. See if I can find it here. Chapter 12, verse 28. Wherefore, we receiving a kingdom which cannot be moved, let us have grace, whereby we may serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear. For our God is a consuming fire. So this aspect of reverence and godly fear, very important. Verse 17, they shall be mine, says the Eternal of Hosts, and the day when I make up my jewels. God views his people as jewels, as diamonds, that are to glisten as a part of his family. I will spare them as a man spares his own son that serves him. What does he spare them from? Tribulation, right, because he's talking about judgment. Judgment is coming. The day is coming, he says. He's warning them. The just shall live by faith in God, that when this day of trouble comes, that those who are really serving God, God will spare. He will protect them. He protects his people before the great tribulation starts. Those who repent in the great tribulation, he will protect before the day of the Lord starts. So it is one of continuing protection for those that serve him. And I like this phrase, as a man spares his own son that serves him. Very important that sons be serving fathers and committed to fathers, which reminds me, I need to call my father. My wife got a call while I was gone that he had passed out and had it was a blood clot. A blood clot can go one of three ways. It either goes to the lungs, it goes to the heart, or to the brain. It kills you. And the last two, thankfully, this one went to his lungs. He had had some problems before. Mom tried to get him in the hospital, and he sets the pace for me in his hard-headedness. He would not go. Felt it'd be okay, but when he passed out that time, then he went and found out that the blood clot had gone to his lungs. So he's still getting through that, and I need to call him and, you know, just talk with him. And I'm looking forward to the summer. You know, you grow up in the church, and you really don't face the fact of your parents dying, I think. At least I never did really to that extent, because, you know, we figured 1975, the end would be over, you know, and And, you know, so I never faced the fact that I'd probably grow old enough to die, you know, before Christ would return. And I still hope not to. I'm not close, I don't think. But who knows? But anyway, my dad has been talking about retiring for a while. Anyway, maybe he will now. I'm going to be going to SMU, and I think I'll stay with him for about 8 weeks and plan on taking in a couple of baseball games and doing some things together. Verse 18, then shall you return and discern between the righteous and the wicked. So he's talking about Christ returning and then that ultimate battle, of course, at the day of the Lord, which is the day Christ returns, between the righteous and the wicked, between him that serves God and him that serves him not. So we have to ask ourselves, are we serving God or are we just serving ourselves? You can work very hard within the work, by the way, and just be serving yourself and not really be serving God. Chapter 4, verse 1, continue with this aspect of judgment. He will discern between the righteous and the wicked, verse 18 of chapter 3. Verse 4, then, the sentence for the wicked is death. For behold, the day comes that they shall burn as an oven, and all the proud, yea, all the wickedly shall be stubble. The day comes that shall burn them up, says the Eternal of Hosts, that it shall leave them neither root nor branch. So the wicked ultimately in judgment are going to be burned up. Now, there are some that are burned up in Christ's second coming by the fire I spoke of in 2 Thessalonians 1, verses 8 and 9. Those don't necessarily have their second chance at that particular point, would be resurrected, have an opportunity to obey God, and yet at least some, I guess we can use that word, will then be burned up in a lake of fire. Revelation chapter 20, the last couple of verses, and chapter 21. So we see the sentence of the wicked is ultimately the lake of fire that leaves them neither root nor branch. There's no memory of them, no existence of them. Revelation chapter 21. Then he goes on talking about the righteous. So we saw the wicked, the skeptics talked about in 13 through 15. We saw the faithful, 16 and 17. We see the judgment of both, verse 18, and the sentence of the wicked, chapter 4, verse 1. Now we see the joy of the righteous. But unto you that fear my name shall the Son of Righteousness arise with healing in his wings. And you shall go forth and grow up as calves of the stall. Calves of the stall have no worry. You grow up without worry, with great joy in the bustling about as calves. It's going to be a joyful life. Amos 9, verse 12. Micah 4, 1 through 5, and verse 13. Micah 4, 1 through 5, and 13. And chapter 7, verse 17. For you shall tread down the wicked. They shall be as ashes under the soles of your feet in the day that I shall do this, says the Eternal of Hosts. So it's a day of triumph. So he ends now, chapter 4, verses 4 through 6, with the conclusion. This is a conclusion of Malachi. I believe it is a fantastic conclusion to the Old Testament. And he makes two major points. Verse 4 is the point that the law and the prophets prepares us for the day of the Lord. The law and the prophets prepare us for the day of the Lord. Verse 4. Remember you the law of Moses, my servant. And we know the law, Ecclesiastes 12, verse 13, we're to fear God, we're to obey the commandments. To fear God and obey the commandments. The law is that law going back to Exodus chapter 21 through 24, as well as the statutes and the judgments after that, as he goes on to say. Remember you the law of Moses my servant, which I commanded unto him in Horeb for all Israel with the statutes and the judgments. So that law is to be a light. Did I give that to you already? Psalms 119, 105. Psalms 119, 105. But the law is a light. Of course, this is what he commanded in Horeb. Horeb is referred to as Sinai, another alternate term for it. So there we see the spiritual law, the statutes, the judgments. And surely 2 Corinthians 3 can be tied in now with the present, or with the New Testament era, which then continues on with the dispensation of grace now, I suppose. But 2 Corinthians 3 says that we live not in the written aspect of the law, but in the spirit of the law. So we add to what was written then, and we understand it with the administration of life, the forgiveness of sins, the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. Verse 5, behold, I will send to you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. So we saw in verse 4 that the law and the prophets prepare us for the day.